And away we go, as one of the cartoon characters from the 60s and 70s used to say.
Dre.
I don't remember who it was. But hello, everyone, on People's Internet Radio and both of Annie Champagne's Shake and Wake radio stations and PSN Radio. Also, thanks to Angela Espino down in Florida, all three of the stations down in Florida and one over in Ireland. Welcome, everyone. It's another Tuesday evening in Ireland. Tuesday afternoon here in America, almost evening, 5 p.m. in the east, and 3 p.m. Mountain Time, where my guest is from. And I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel Like a Ball. I want to welcome back a really good guest, a really good, well, I consider him a friend. I hope he considers me a friend. But
Sure enough, sure enough.
somewhat of a maligned underground scientist. So I think we're going to talk about science today. I'm quite sure, as we normally do. But I want to welcome back David Yurt to the show.
Hi, Stephen. Nice to talk with you again.
Yes, welcome back. We missed last week. Had the wife had a little issue she had to deal with. But hope everything's okay with that, right?
Well, we're working on it. When you get old, things happen. So you have to be a little bit adaptable from time to time. She's been really struggling the last few years. She's a cancer survivor, and 10 years on after chemo and radiation therapy, we discovered that her teeth were beginning to disintegrate,
Oh, goodness.
and that's not an uncommon long-term side effect.
Correct, yeah.
But during the last year, 14 months, been trying to replace her disintegrating teeth with dentures and bridges and other kinds of things, and that's a difficult proposition. You start replacing your teeth, which are really the crystals that operate in your electrical system, replacing those with pieces of plastic and ceramic changes the way things work, it changes the mouth, it changes the way she eats, it changes the fact that she can't taste nearly as well or as completely. She can't chew well. She has a lot of pain in her gums. So it's been a real quest for her. And we've been working on some remediation issues here, trying to cut down on the pain and give her a little bit better flexibility and enable her to chew and taste and so on. But it's not an easy process. We can't afford to do implants. And even if we could, one of the results of the chemotherapy is that her platelets so reduced in count that they don't dare do surgery on her because they're afraid she'll bleed out. So we live with what we got. And that's what
Yes.
that was all about. So
Yes.
thanks for giving me a week off.
Well,
See if we can make up for it today.
yeah. I did tell you that I did tell you back a couple of months back that my mother did just pass a day after Christmas, December 26th, but actually what ended up being 30 years ago, 1989 in October 1989, or November, one or the other. I don't remember now, but she had colon cancer, and she had a colonoscopy. They give her the bag on her side and give her the chemo and give her the radiation and give her the whole treatment. And she was a 30-year survivor. In the hospital, each and every doctor was just astonished that she had survived 30 years from colon cancer, because normally that doesn't even happen.
Do they have any idea what contributed to that?
No, not at all.
No ideas, huh?
No. But actually what did ended up taking her life was the complications from the radiation and the chemotherapy from 30 years ago. It finally just ate away at too many other organs on the inside of her, and she was never able to recover. But that's a different story.
It is a different story, and in one of these programs, we're going to talk about the way technologies and the way medicine and the way consciousness can be used to really effectively deal with cancer and other kinds of life-threatening illnesses and diseases, because there are some direct connections there. And science is getting better at it. Medical science is getting a little better at it. The pharmaceutical companies are finding more effective ways to resist it and avoid it. So it's an interesting landscape out there, but it's a subject for which we have a great deal of information that never really gets discussed. So we'll take one of our programs and dedicate it to that subject.
Yes, absolutely. So, what is the topic? I know that you said consciousness. I believe it was the stuff that somebody
the stuff Descartes left out.
Descartes left out. Yes. So, who was Descartes? He was a scientist, right?
He was one of the original scientists. Lived in the 17th century in France. And Descartes was the guy who made a deal on behalf of the collective community of naturalists, made a deal with the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church was in some trouble, because just 30 years earlier, Galileo had discovered and then proved that the Earth was not the center of the universe. And before him was Copernicus, and after him was a long list of really bright, well-informed, really intelligent people who decided early on that there was this fundamental difference between the physical stuff and what he called the spirit stuff. He referred more to it in his writings as the mental stuff, all the things that in the day couldn't be seen or measured or quantified. That stuff remained by consensus the preferred territory of the Catholic Church. And he was pretty much given free rein to characterize the physical stuff however he found it. And that's part of the legacy that we've inherited in the current culture, is the fact that with infrequent and rare exceptions, research resources, people and money and time and equipment, are seldom dedicated to exploring the proposition of the connection between the mind and the physical world. We talked quite a bit about that last time, which if you're interested in going through this process with us, means that at some point we have to come to grips with a fundamental issue, and that is the issue of what is consciousness? What is it?
Okay.
Do you have notions about that? When somebody says, well, what is consciousness? What goes through your mind?
What goes through my mind? Mm-hmm. I guess maybe sentient feelings, sentient knowing that you are sentient, or knowing that you have feelings, knowing that you have maybe not original thoughts, but knowing that you have thoughts.
Well, Descartes was the guy who came up with the notorious saying, cogito ergo sum, which translated from the Latin means, I think, therefore I am.
Okay, I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, and he's the guy that first formulated and uttered it, and it follows us now all the way from the middle of the 17th century. So it's not a new idea. But the issue is, how is it that in this physical stuff that we occupy with what remains to be defined as the mind, how do those things operate? Where do they come from? How do they link up? How are they coupled? And how do we know? Those are all questions that have fostered the production of enough books to fill an entire library and then some.
Well,
the ultimate questions.
Sure. I mean, if you're a Darwinian Darwinian follower, we all stem from some protozoan amoeba that come out of the ocean 330 million years ago, and well, we all evolved from there. But you know, if I have seen scientists and I have heard science that indicates that there's a higher presence at large, a I don't know, millions call it God, or billions call it God, but
well, it's a confusing subject, isn't it?
Sure.
I mean, it's really subject to interpretation, and you know, we didn't get an instruction manual when we got involved in this process called mortality.
Correct.
And the ultimate question then is, well, if there were biological life forms in the ocean, the question ultimately goes to, where did they come from?
Right.
Why were they there?
Right.
I mean, in all of the goop that science has messed with in all of the years and laboratories that they've been trying to sort out this business about what animates matter, what is life, as far as I'm aware, nobody that I have read about in the work that I've been doing the last 50 years has found a way to create life from matter. We don't know how to do it. And the notion of science, based on the legacies of all of the other work that's been done before us and the cultural heritage that we've inherited, means that the big argument in science has always been that consciousness is the result, the product of increasingly sophisticated complexity in the organization of matter. That you don't get to consciousness until matter gets sufficiently complicated that it then becomes self-aware, or it becomes operational in some way.
Okay. Does that work with animals that are cloned and have been cloned the last 30 years?
Well, when they clone animals, they don't start with inanimate matter.
Okay.
They start with living matter.
Sure.
Right? They start with mitochondrial DNA, and they
use
the tools that are available to get it to replicate itself, but they don't animate it. It's alive when they start.
Okay. So they don't go out and get the carbon, the nitrogen, the helium, and all the other elements and
amino acids and create proteins and create this. No, that doesn't happen.
Well, you know what? I heard a joke many years ago. I mean, would you like to hear it?
Sure.
A scientist is talking to God, and he says, you know, I can do anything that you have done through science. And God says, well, go ahead and create man. And the scientist says, okay, I will. He walks out to the outside and grabs some dirt, and God says, no, make your own dirt.
Well, there's a joke among philosophers.
Okay.
Right? And the joke goes like this. Descartes walks into a coffee shop, sits down at the counter. The waiter says, what would you like? He said, I'd like a coffee. Would you like sugar? Descartes says, I don't think so, and he disappears.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I
mean,
I think, therefore, I am. I don't think so. I am
right.
Not.
Right.
Right. Well, that's the joke. Philosophers have that. So, you know, let's kind of have this conversation a little bit here. We've talked in earlier segments about how matter is organized and how energy and matter and time and all of those things appear to be part of a self-renewing cycle that goes from inside the physical vacuum to outside to create whatever realms of reality they are, which then devolve and return in their constituents back to the physical vacuum. And in that embracing model, which uses the physical vacuum as the irresistible source, the infinite source of chaotic, disorganized, not unorganized, potential to become everything that we see. And that black holes and other means of catastrophic annihilation that are now known to operate in the universe strip all that apart and take it back to basics and return it back to the physical vacuum. And that becomes an endless cycle. It's self-renewing. It's vital. It's fundamental. It's really essential to everything we think we know about how the cosmos operates and how nature works. So the issue becomes, you know, well, what about consciousness? We've talked in earlier programs about the evidence we have, which shows, unarguably, in my opinion, that consciousness, identity, predates mortality and survives beyond mortality and ultimately repeats in mortality in an endless cycle. Well, isn't that an interesting metaphor for the way the physical model works? Science has not yet adopted these concepts as part of the fundamental standard model. That's not part of science. It is part of the heresy that has been driven and recorded and documented and experimentally verified by a bunch of really smart people who are a heck of a lot smarter than I am. And one of the critical ingredients of this conversation has to be the discovering the relationship between the mind, between consciousness, the capacity to be aware that we are aware while in this physical bodysuit, and retain that awareness even after this bodysuit goes away. So one of my favorite science guys from the last century is a guy by the name of David Bohm, B-O-H-M. Bohm is widely regarded as perhaps the most significant theoretical physicist of the 20th century, a really, really smart guy. And in his writings and in the subsequent writings of others who followed in his footsteps, there is this conversation that says there is wholeness in the cosmos, and that underlying that wholeness, there is what he called an implicate order. Explicate order is an order that operates from the outside that's imposed on a system. Implicate order is a kind of order that operates from within the system, and that makes the system operate as it does. It wasn't until the mid-90s that we really understood what the rules of that implicate order are. At least we know some of them. When Per Bach and his colleagues at the Brookhaven National Laboratories went through the sandpile experiment, they discovered after 10,000 iterations of the experiment that the world operates in ways that are not consistent with linear predictive models. That is, what science wants to know is, if we know what happened yesterday, does that give us the capacity to predict what's going to happen in the future with any regularity or accuracy? And in open, complex, self-organizing systems like the planet and the solar system and the cosmos and the human body and biological systems and DNA and all those things, which are all open, complex, self-organizing systems, there are rules that apply that are the rules that drive the functions of this underlying implicate order. And what Bohm suggested was that the implicate order manifests itself in terms of fractal geometries. So if you look at, he didn't call them fractal geometries. We didn't get that word until the 50s when Benoit Mandelbrot at IBM intuited just out of nowhere. He had this brain cramp one day and discovered that there are thresholds of organization between which there is no other evidence of organization. And he figured out how to express that mathematically in terms of a fraction that he called a fractal. Well, if you look at fractals as the history of the process of self-organization, then you begin to understand what unfoldment looks like. For example, if you look at forests from the space station, they are self-similar in every regard at every scale. A conifer forest is a conifer forest because the order that creates the trees themselves and the environment in which they exist and the way they aggregate together and the way they live in that biome together represents the manifestation of the way their physical stuff is organized as a function of their genetic makeup. So all forests of similar species look like those forests of those species. The same is true of animal forms. If you look at the way the DNA operates to express the forms of biological systems, then the ancient Chinese notion about the observer and the means of observation not being detachable from that which is being observed means that in the manifestation of different species of birds, different species of butterflies, different species of fish, different species of ants, those species are specific in the general form, and they are absolutely discrete with respect to individuation. Every individual is identifiable by one means or another with mutually exclusive specificity. All the ants look the same, but they're not. All the butterflies look the same, but they're not.
Okay.
And it helps us to understand why it is that butterflies can communicate with each other, but nothing else communicates with the butterflies. Or birds of a species communicate with each other over long distances. They all look the same. They have things in common in their organizational structure that are the unfolding of the underlying order. Now the question becomes, at whatever level of consciousness you want to approach this, Rupert Sheldrake asked some really fundamental questions in his book, Seven Questions That Would Change the World. And I highly recommend that to your viewers because it's easy reading, but it's really profound stuff. And he's talking about things like the 100 monkey syndrome, right? You're familiar with that.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Okay. So in the 100 monkey syndrome, just to remind your people, a Japanese island populated by monkeys of a particular species were introduced as part of an experiment to sweet potatoes. They'd never seen sweet potatoes before. The objective of the original experiment was to discover whether the way they treated naturally occurring foods in their environment would be the same if they were introduced to a brand new kind of food. So they put a bag of sweet potatoes by a stream in the forest and backed off and took notes and made photographs and paid attention to the behaviors. And the way the behavior manifested among those animals on that island, which was, you know, miles and miles away from any other island, was replicated on another island at the same time with the same result without there being any communication between them. There was no way for them to communicate directly in a linear way.
Right.
Nevertheless, the information introduced in the first island was somehow generalized and communicated to other islands almost at the same time, but with precise specificity. Well, the question becomes, how the hell does that happen? How does that work? How do you know that someone is staring at you from behind? How do swallows who find a food source in one space attract swallows from as many as 50 miles away to the food source? How does that happen? It's been documented over and over and over again. So there's a field that operates. The issue is, what is this function that operates in the field as part of your physical biology that is able to perceive and process and interpret information and communicate it in a way that is not only not linear, but it is instantaneous across time and space? I mean, that sounds like pretty wild stuff, but the fact of the matter is that when you read the writings of people like David Bohm, all these issues that revolve around consciousness, what it is and how it operates, and what is mind, and how does it operate, and where does it come from? Those things all take a completely different flavor from the kind of interpretation that's provided by science when you look at what Bohm says about the implicate order of things. And I'm going to read a quote here because I think it's really profound. It is fair to say that the universe demonstrates undivided wholeness at the most fundamental level. As a primary principle of cosmic order, it is consistent to say the whole must be seen as manifesting self-referent order at all scales. The cosmos must, in other words, self-referentially be aware of itself as reality in itself. Otherwise, it would not manifest orderliness as evidenced by the fractal record of evolution, which is the prior condition for all manifestations of being. Now, that's real serious thinking. And for the benefit of those who are not familiar with the vocabulary, let's talk a little bit about what he's saying here. When he says that the whole must be seen as manifesting self-referential order at all scales, what he's saying is that the universe operates in an orderly way. It's not consistent or the same everywhere, but it is orderly in its entirety. And that can't happen by accident. There is no approximation for the probability that the universe, the entire cosmos, and all of the subsystems everywhere at every scale operate with orderliness if there is not among the dynamics of the implicate order a way for it to be self-referential. Well, sentience, the ability to realize that you have the ability to realize, is self-referential at its basis. That's what it is. That's a pretty profound idea when you say reality in itself, the whole of it taken altogether, has to be self-referential. Otherwise, it would be utterly chaotic. And of course, it is not. Pick up a telescope, look anywhere in the sky in the night, walk around the planet anytime during the day, pick up a microscope, put anything you want underneath it, you'll discover that everything operates with a degree of order.
Correct, but how do we know if all this is real? I know we've spoken about this before.
Sure, of course. And part of the answer to that devolves back to a prior discussion that we had in an earlier conversation about how do we know what we know about the physical stuff, right? In science, the Western methodology operates in a framework that says our paradigm is that all the physical stuff is made of finer, more finely granulated stuff. So if we can figure out how to dismantle this clockwork mechanism called physical reality down to its smallest, finest, most indivisible particle, called by Democritus the atom, if we can do that, then we know what reality is.
Right.
We know what it is.
Right.
So you take science across all the eons of time, and you look at what we know today after 200 and however many years of, you know, dedicated scientific investigation, and you look at the models. We've talked about the problem with quantum electrodynamics and the problem with quantum mechanics and the problem with being able to reconcile how the information is interpreted, and the fact that the best physicists on the planet diddled with the numbers to get the result they wanted to match the model they created, despite the fact that the evidence their experiments created was not in compliance with their math. Right? They lied to each other.
Yes.
And they perpetrated it with each other. So science has an issue. At the same time, you know, you look at, go ahead.
Does science have an issue, or does the fact that science needs funding have an issue?
No, it's not about the money. It's about being right.
Okay.
It's about being right. The problem with academic scientific credentials is that, by and large, the cult of science relies on the validity of what they know that resulted in their being granted the credentials is indispensable and indisputable. And to the extent that indispensable and indisputable then becomes obviated by new information, then their credentials are at risk. And so we have in today's world a body of science, a cult of science, that while its practitioners are wonderful, bright, dedicated, talented, really dedicated people, the business of science continuously gets in the way of the truth. Notwithstanding that conversation, we have a model based on this deductive process, right? Deduction, taking things apart one piece at a time to get to the finest, smallest, most finely granulated particle of matter. Well, Murray Gell-Mann in the 80s got a Nobel Prize because he was able to verify three different varieties of subatomic components called quarks, claiming that the quark was the fundamental indivisible particle of matter in the universe. And then 7 years later, a bunch of people that studied and worked with him at the Fermi Labs attempted to publish a paper based on 7 years of data that showed that quarks are divisible. And they did divide them, and they did keep the data, and they did prove it, and they published a paper, and then the scientific establishment descended on the publication on Nature, the bedrock of best science publishing, and threatened to take them out of existence if they published that paper. They also threatened to revoke the credentials of the 450 people, the technicians and scientists and mathematicians and engineers, who signed the document on behalf of the CDI collaboration at Fermilabs. And that article was never published. Some of us got copies of it because we're part of that scientific community and we do some peer review work. I still have my copy, but you won't find it on the internet because it was suppressed, because it invalidated the credentials of the scientists who then became the guys that are in charge of deciding who gets the money. The very best science information that we have was replicated over a 10-year period in the early 20s by a couple of people who were taught how to meditate by an Eastern mystic named Krishnamurti. And Charlie Leadbeater and Annie Besant accumulated information from their meditations, this inductive, not deductive, inductive process, and they penetrated down to the source of all being, kept track of all the pieces, named them, drew them, kept impeccable notes, and published a book called Occult Chemistry. You can still buy it from the Theosophical Society in Chicago. I have a copy. And along comes Philip Green, 1980s. He is a PhD candidate. His dissertation takes all the very best of the standard physical models, descriptions, and discoveries about the most finely developed components of the physical world using conventional deductive science and formulas and math and names and diagrams, and compared that with occult chemistry. And guess what he discovered? He discovered that the use of the inductive method provided at least as fine a level of detail with significantly greater clarity and consistency than the mathematically supported deductive model. And in fact, they both described exactly the same thing. So here's the issue. That consciousness, that mind that operates in a way that enables us to penetrate, to understand, and actually perceive directly, not through the senses, but through our consciousness alone, reality in itself at its fundamental basis. That is consciousness. It operates because it is self-referent and because it is a product of a cosmos that operates by rules that are also self-referential everywhere at all scales. How does that work? We've talked a little in the past about a scientist whose work I think is just extraordinarily good. Her name is Candace Pert. And while she was a postdoctoral student, she developed at her own cost in a laboratory, at her own expense, on her own time, with her own resources, a protocol which enabled her to discover materials that operate in the human condition called neuropeptides. These are amino acids.
I've heard of them. Not sure what they are, but I've heard of them.
They have a very specific purpose in the human bionomy. And here's how it works. At the surface level, in the most simplistic explanation of this, what Candace identified was the existence on the surface of virtually every cell in the human body, a set of receptors. And the peptides, in their various formulations, these proteinaceous peptide forms, connect to those little hooks And the nature of the peptide defines what we experience as emotion. Now, science has yet to undertake a deliberate, rigorous investigation of how that works. That it works is no longer arguable.
Why do you think that is?
You mean, why has science not investigated it?
Yes.
Well, here's maybe this is not an adequate answer, but it's certainly not uncommon. I mean, medical textbooks didn't include the immune system as an integral part of the human body until 1991. And Candace Pert discovered that all the cells that operate in the immune system have these neuropeptide receptors attached to the surfaces. How the heck is that supposed to happen? Oh, by the way, they're connected to nerve tissue. by the way, there isn't any kind of tissue in the body that does not have neuropeptide receptors.
Right.
Right? So she identified 27 specific neuropeptides, and she was able to establish with rigorous, really impeccable science that when specific neuropeptides are fed to a specific through a specific kind of solution into the body, that it induces an emotional experience. Well, that's pretty interesting. I mean, that's pretty interesting. And then other researchers who pursued her work later discovered that something else was going on with these neuropeptides and these emotional states that are being induced by the chemistry. There's a linear process. The nervous system information exchange rate in the neurons never operates faster than about a thousandth of a second. Most of it is much, much slower than that. But there are occasions when the neuropeptides communicate throughout the body with virtually zero time lapse, instantaneous everywhere in the body, as if operating in a singular field that operates outside the linear data transport function of the chemistry.
Isn't that supposed to be impossible?
It is reality. Now, so we've described it. Now the issue is to figure out how the heck does it work? Well, here's some interesting information. We've talked about this a little before. Great book, Peter Tompkins, Christopher Bird, The Secret Life of Plants.
Yes, yes.
Right? If you want to see how that phenomenon works in the macro world, read that great little book. Read that book. It's filled with information that demonstrates impeccably documented phenomena which enable consciousness and choice to operate instantaneously at a distance between people and plants, between people and animals, between plants and other plants. So there is a field, there is a threshold, there is a mechanism by which the capacity to make choice, to process information, and with focus and deliberate choice, convey information elsewhere instantaneously without regard to time and distance across species. It's being done more and more, documented more and more now, because this phenomenon is really important. And then, you know, you get into the conversation about, well, what makes it useful? Well, here's what makes it useful. Start at the basics. In Italy, in the 80s, experiments were conducted by the Transcendental Meditation folks, and they were able to demonstrate that if you take a dozen professional meditators, they teach people how to meditate, professional meditators, put them in a single building, but each one in a separate room with no physical means of communication, within a matter of minutes, all 12 of those meditators will have absolutely identical alpha state waveforms operating in their bodies. Absolutely identical within a matter of minutes.
Sure.
Well,
that was,
excuse me.
Right. There's been a lot of ancient cultures that have been said to have done that.
Sure.
In the past. And there are probably some cultures that still do that today.
Of course there are.
The Buddhists.
Of course there are. I mean, this is Dr. Dean Radin, one of my favorite writers about this. Certainly the world expert on this stuff in the Western world, has written voluminous material that talks about these things that we refer to as paranormal and metaphysical and psychokinetic and so on and so forth. Probably the most dramatic demonstration of the use of consciousness as a tool was during the days when remote viewing was being pursued by both the Russians and the CIA. Hal Puthoff and the guys with Ingo Swann at SAIC and then later in the Army proved that you can go places with your consciousness deliberately and see and remember and record in your recollection and return to the place you started and draw the picture and write it.
How about
and describe it?
What do you think about into the future? There's an interesting question in the chat for you.
Well, into the future means that if you operate in the context of the standard model of physics, time is a demonstration of entropy. That is, that it is a dimension on its own that is both scalable and quantifiable. So you can only go in one direction. But when you get below a certain level of organizational complexity, there is no time. There is no matter. Nothing is linear. That's one of the things we now know with absolute certainty. That's not arguable.
Okay.
We've proved that we can take physical devices into a place where we can suspend the rules of organization that are manifest as time and distance and communicate instantaneously without regard to time and distance with absolute precision, and we can do it repeatedly.
Okay. Well, the question in the chat is, why does our sleeping mode have amazing dreams that can be seen years later and real life consequences?
Dude, that's a great question.
I saw the internet. He says,
yeah?
I saw the internet before it existed in my dreams in 1979, as in what we do now. Well, before it existed, if that makes any sense.
Of course it makes sense. Of course it does. Look, here's the physical proof that's replicable. And in the few minutes that are left to us, let's talk about, you know, what does that mean?
Okay.
If you're familiar with a guy named Edgar Cayce.
Sure. Certainly.
Right? I mean, here's a guy, time and distance meant nothing to him.
Right.
I mean, the future was just another part of reality. And he was able to go there and with real specificity and precision tell people, you know, what was going to happen. And he's not the only one, but he's certainly the most prolific.
Right, right.
Of the ones that we know about. At the CERN, CERN, nuclear accelerator facility in Geneva, Switzerland, before they built the supercollider, they also had a particle accelerator. And one of the chief scientists, a guy named Nicolas Gizan, developed an experiment intended to determine whether it is possible to transport information at a virtually infinite speed, velocity, or whether the speed of light is the upper limit to information transport at all scales. That was the objective. So what he did in those days, and now we do it all the time with scanning electron apparatus that's used for microscopy and magnetic resonance imaging and so on. We create what they call a positron electron pair. So you have a unit of matter called an electron with a negative charge, and another unit of matter that is constructed of precisely the same material but operates with a positive charge. So you have a positron and an electron in a pair, and they're married, and the net value of their pairing is zero. It's called a zero-sum bond. Well, he figured out that if you propel an electron-positron pair onto the surface of a material called potassium niobate in its formation as a crystal, you can literally, like a digital quantum knife, cut them apart. You can separate them at the point of a conjunction. He then took fiber optics, shot them out at a right angle from the center at 15 kilometers in each direction, and out on the end of each of those this photonic apparatus that he developed, he had an apparatus that also would exert an effect on one or the other that would either change its polarity or change other characteristics. The notion is part of what they call Gödel's theorem. The thought experiment is that if quantum mechanics operates as they envision it early on, when the attributes of one of the pairs is changed, regardless of where the other component is in the cosmos, regardless of the time and distance, that it is supposed to alter its characteristics to maintain the zero-sum balance of the pairing. Well, that's, until you had fiber optic cable, that wasn't possible. But at a distance of 30 kilometers from the center, now time can be measured in terms of the speed of light with very high precision, out to 9 decimals. What they discovered when they performed that experiment several hundred times was that every time at the point of arrival, when the constituents, when the characteristics of one of the constituents was changed, the other instantaneously to 10 decimal points behind the zero accommodated by changing its own characteristics. That means flat out that information is transported at the quantum level at least 1 billion times faster than the speed of light. 10 to the 9 times faster than the speed of light. That means there's something going on in reality as it is that enables information to be transported, to be sent and received and responded to instantaneously with absolute spontaneity everywhere, anywhere in the cosmos. So if you want to talk about the dream time, read Carlos Castaneda. He was a social anthropologist who went to the University of California at Berkeley and UCLA in the early 70s. He created a revolution all by himself, wrote many books, and was able to discover what it is about his consciousness and consciousness in the human equation generally that makes it possible to engage in what is called lucid dreaming. Lucid dreaming is a dream state in which all aspects of all time in all where are instantly available, and while you're dreaming, you get to choose to go there. And you can go to any number of institutes, the Esalen Institute and others, where they will literally teach you to do that. You can buy the books on the internet that will teach you how to do lucid dreaming. I've done it for 30 years.
People have been doing what's called astral projecting too.
Sure. You betcha. So take remote viewing, take out-of-body experiences, take lucid dreaming, take all of these things that are part of the dynamic, the self-referential dynamic that makes the universe operate the way it is, and then you begin to have some insight into how ridiculous it is to suggest that consciousness is a product of increasingly sophisticated complexity in just organizing the physical stuff. The physical stuff is just one part of reality as it is. There are underlying levels of organizational complexity in other dimensional form that operate together to create the cosmos as it is. And we're a long way from having a really clear understanding about how all that works. But the one thing we can be absolutely certain of is that consciousness is the source of the physical reality, not a product of it. Of that you can be quite clear. And there's lots of wonderful information available that helps you to get to the place where you can really have the opportunity, if you're willing to do the work, to experience reality as it is directly with your consciousness and not through the instruments of your physicality, like your taste buds and your, and you know, the nerve endings on your skin and so on. I mean, otherwise, we're just a local linear detection and reflection apparatus that operates within fairly limited parameters because our physical equipment has pretty narrowly defined, rigidly functional limits. We can only hear so low, so high. We can only see certain colors and wavelengths. We can only feel certain things at a fineness. Our capacity to see the world as it is with our physical stuff is so fundamentally limited and so unreliable and inconsistent that until we figure out how to rely on our consciousness to actually do what Charlie Leadbeater and Annie Besant and many others have done, find a way to experience reality as it is directly with our consciousness, then you begin to understand what it is we're dealing with here.
Certainly. And we're pretty much at the hour here, David.
Okay, buddy. Well, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for the questions.
Yes.
Regards to your listeners, and we'll hopefully see them again next week.
Absolutely. I'm going to send you.
Be well. Thanks much.
All right. Have a good day. All right, everyone. Take a quick break here, and I'm going to look for some other things to do. So be right back here in just a few minutes.